A Norwegian energy company that owns 3 polysilicon plants in the United States has laid off 60 employees, including 26 in Butte. REC Silicon ASA announced the layoffs yesterday, blaming market weakness and a trade war between the United States and China for the layoffs. REC Silicon Director of Operations Rich Green tells the Montana Standards the layoffs went into effect immediately and the employees were given a severance package. Positions were cut in a variety of departments at the REC Silicon plant southwest of Butte, which employs 294 people. REC Silicon produces polysilicon and silane gas for the solar and electronics industries. Green says the company hopes to maintain the same level of production following the layoffs.
And in other news from around the state, Congressman Steve Daines was not the only new candidate to jump into the race for Montana's open 2014 Senate seat this week. Two-term former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger quietly announced his intentions at a dinner held by the Lewis and Clark County Democratic Central Committee. That announcement was largely overshadowed by Daines's high-profile Senate bid event yesterday. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says Bollinger describes himself as the Democratic candidate most able to beat Daines.
Come in.
Former Lieutenant Governor John Bollinger lives in a beautiful old house on Helena's west side, living with his wife and excitable poodle.
Sophie, no barking.
The 77-year-old former Marine ran a women's clothing store in Billings for more than 30 years. He didn't enter politics until his 50s, serving 3 terms in the Montana House and then 2 terms in the Senate, all as a Republican. He then angered the state GOP by joining the ticket of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Brian Schweitzer in 2004. Bollinger says he has always been a moderate.
I think that we have to move to the middle in order to move forward.
But he says he pursued some pretty progressive bills in the state legislature, including gun control, pollution control, and anti-discrimination bills. He's hoping that will be enough to appeal to Democrats in the primary race. So far, he's facing political unknown Wilsall area rancher Dirk Adams and current Lieutenant Governor John Walsh. Walsh has already received support of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and an endorsement from Senator John Tester. Bollinger calls that inappropriate.
I think it's the people of the state of Montana that should choose the candidate, not these political operatives that work within the party.
He lists his political priorities if elected as bringing home America's military forces.
Put those people to work, restoring our infrastructure.
He also wants to reform the nation's tax code and change Senate rules to remove the filibuster. He says his statewide name recognition and 20 years of public policy experience make him the best suited to defeat Congressman Daines. Bollinger had been considering the race for months, but says the 16-day government shutdown in October and Daines' votes, which initially supported that stalemate, finally made the decision for him.
That was a serious mistake. Caused a great deal of pain for Montanans and people of this country.
Daines is the heavy favorite in the Republican primary. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Western Montana feminist, social justice advocate, and longtime Montana Public Radio commentator Judy Smith died yesterday after a lengthy battle with cancer. Edward O'Brien has more on the life and legacy of a woman remembered today as a warrior by those who knew her.
Judy Smith's commentaries for Montana Evening Edition always had a unique rhythm and arrangement. They usually started with an innocuous observation, like this one from March of 2009 when she told us about a noisy flicker that was furiously pecking trees and posts in her neighborhood.
He's pretty loud this time of year, both with that long wickering call and the peck, peck, pecking as he tests out potential new homes. Right now he is trying it at one of the old elms in my front yard. I keep telling him it isn't dead yet and he should move on, but every day when I arrive home I hear the tapping on a stub of a large branch.
And if you were even vaguely familiar with Smith's style, you knew she'd get right to the point.
The finches and chickadees ignore him. Occasionally he chases around with the squirrels, probably because he taps near one of their nests. But I was telling him yesterday that homelessness was a growing problem, and if he could actually build his own through self-help housing, he was better off than many families in Montana.
The rest of that commentary that was recorded at the height of the Great Recession focused on housing issues affecting low-income Montanans. Smith came to Missoula in the early 70s from Austin, Texas. She was at that time and for the rest of her life deeply involved in the women's movement, economic, social, and environmental justice issues. Don Walsh interviewed Smith in 2001 for the Montana Feminist History Project. In this recording, courtesy of the University of Montana's Maureen and Mike Mansfield Libraries Archives and Special Collections Department, Smith described herself as a feminist anarchist, a philosophy that she said was far less threatening than it sounds.
Most people have a very strange idea about anarchism as something about bombs and people wearing black and weird things. But really, anarchism is about the idea that people shouldn't have power over each other, that the struggle is to have authentic relationships with people as equals and to build institutions that reinforce that potential in people.
Smith helped found Missoula's Women's Place, which offered domestic violence counseling and support services, Homeward, providing affordable and sustainable housing, Women's Opportunity and Resource Development, Blue Mountain Clinic, and the Smart Growth Coalition, among others. MTPR commentator Terry Kendrick says Smith knew she was a natural leader.
She wasn't a shrinking violet, but she also saw herself as part of a community. And her role, I think, from the 1960s, that perception that you can change the world, that a small group of people can change the world, really never left her. That even though she became involved in sort of more legit enterprises, she was always the protester, the advocate, the agitator.
Nonprofit manager and consultant Sally Mullen first met Smith in 1975. Mullen and Smith were founding members of Missoula's Blue Mountain Clinic. Mullen says Judy Smith's passion and drive were off the charts.
On a scale of 1 to 10, she was about a 15 in the passion department. And the thing about Judy is that she also had enormous drive and big brain that she brought together to move, the agenda on those passions forward. She was a really interesting combination and also was a terrific face for wherever she was representing because she was so incredibly articulate. You already know she had her PhD in biochemistry, but she also had an ability to kind of get people on board to change the world.
Former Congressman Pat Williams says Smith was a friend, one he deeply admired.
I was always surprised at how aggressive and determined and continuing her activism was. She was truly a force of energy, particularly around Missoula. Judy, for the most part, could enjoy a conversation with those who weren't in support of what she was doing, as well as enjoying a conversation with those who were in support of what she was doing.
Terry Kendrick says she loves that Smith was born on the 4th of July.
She'd spent so much of her time working against the status quo in government and whatever that I really got a kick out of that. But then I also think that it's, 4th of July is Independence Day, and Judy was definitely an independent woman.
Judy Smith was 69 years old. For Montana Evening Edition, I'm Edward O'Brien.
Renowned environmental historian Char Miller will speak about this century's environmental and social challenges at a free public lecture tonight on the University of Montana campus. Miller is an expert on U.S. environmental history and politics, as well as public land management. Miller says the conversation about how our changing climate is affecting land management is long overdue.
And in part, it's overdue because of the resistance to the very concept of climate change and the notion that the planet is warming that has become such a political battleground. But the science is really clear. There is no doubt in anyone's mind that sees this material, this data, that this stuff is happening. If birds can figure it out, if aspens can figure it out, why can't human beings?
Miller's talk tonight begins at 7 o'clock in the North Underground Lecture Hall on the University of Montana campus. We'll have a feature interview with Miller tomorrow during Montana Evening Edition.
Like many, Brock Evans fell in love with Glacier National Park the minute he set eyes on it. And his first visit there as a young man began his lifelong commitment to conservation. Evans is a past lobbyist for the Sierra Club and current president of the National Endangered Species Coalition. His career as an environmental activist spans 50 years. Evans returned to Montana this week to lecture and visit old friends. In this feature interview, Evans talks with news director Sally Mock about the environmental movement and his ongoing passion for conservation.
Most people who become environmentalists have an an awakening or an aha movement. And I'd grown up as an Ohio boy and in a pleasant family and a very Republican family, by the way. And then I went to law. I went to school on the East Coast, and I went to law school at the University of Michigan. And so the reason I'm here now talking is because I did not like my first year in law school very much. And I survived it, but I didn't like. So I wanted to get a summer job doing anything but going back to Columbus and being an apprentice lawyer or something. So I went across the street and got a summer job in a place called Glacier National Park at one of the hotels, Many Glacier Hotel. And I thought, well, you know, that must be in Alaska someplace. That's a good far away because I have glaciers in it. And I'll never forget the experience going on the train, going Minneapolis across the Dakotas and then in eastern Montana. And 24 hours later, I woke up and we're clickety-clack, still going west. And I went up to the observation dome then to the old Great Northern and sat next to an older guy. He probably was about 30 or so. And I said, my goodness, sir, those clouds are certainly low on the mountain, on the horizon out there. He says, them ain't clouds on them, the Rocky Mountains. Oh, my God. And so the moment I stepped off the train at East Glacier Park, there were the great peaks rising right out of the prairies and the ice-pure creeks tumbling down from the heavens. You could feel them and the sweet smell of the pines. And it was like some old lost chord was plucked inside the deepest part of me, and it sang a song. And the song has been singing ever since. This is your home. This is your home. Come here. So then it was only a question of surviving law school, and which I did, and then moving out west. Decided not to come to Montana. It was cheaper to take the bar exam in Seattle than any other place then. So, and they had two mountain ranges, one on either side. So that's what I was there for. So we went there. My wife was from Boston, so they had salt water in the middle. And we just made our home there. And I was really happy for a while. And this is part of the story. And I took the climbing course, and I climbed everywhere, and I was so happy. And then all at once I realized something really wrong was going on out there in the National Forest. They were logging all these places I would dream about all in one summer and go there with nothing but a big pile of down ancient forest, big trees of jackstraws of mud and slice. And I got very unhappy, and so I became a passionate conservationist in the 60s.
And you really got into the movement before there was a movement in some ways, because none of the federal legislation had been passed at that point. The Wilderness Act was 1964, Endangered Species Act, and NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, all came after your awakening. You were part of the creation of those.
It's a very good point to remember, because some people get gloomy. Oh, no, these are hard times right now. Well, they're hard times, but they're always hard times if you love the earth and want to protect it. But I remind them there was a time within our lifetimes when there were no environmental laws whatsoever. Yes, there was the Wilderness Act, but that didn't protect anything. You had to get a law passed to get that. I mean, it was good, but was there? But there's no such thing as NEPA or the Endangered Species Act. You couldn't go, going to court was not an option. There was nothing there. So you had to stand and fight politically for whatever you wanted to get. And those were scary times indeed, but it also had to be the same time, as you know, that the anti-war movement and the feminist movement and civil rights movement, all these things were coming along too. And something seemed to catch the American people on fire all over the country. And we were lucky out here because the Northwest really came alive then.
Mr. Evans, I've spoken to a lot of the pioneers in the movement over the years, and some are discouraged. Mm. You're not one of them. You really see great hope in the generations to come after that they will carry the torch.
I do. And I've even written a book about it, which we might come back to. But I'm an optimist, and I tell this when I speak to student groups or others. Oh, I know you think it's all too late and too bad and so on and so on. I said, no. I said, why am I an optimist? Why am I? And some of my friends say, well, oh, Evan, you just drank too much of that Potomac River water. That's why you're an optimist. But I'm an optimist because I've lived through it, and I've witnessed it. And I've witnessed what seemed to be miracles happening, which is people taking on hopeless lost causes. Like, say, saving the Magruder Corridor right here in the Bitterroot Valley. That was hopeless. 175,000 acres going to be logged for sure. But because of a woman named Doris Miller, lives down around Hamilton, and her friends, now it's part of the wilderness area. And I've seen it again and again. And I've been involved in these campaigns all around the country now. I'm working with wonderful people. And what I say to people is, if you don't believe me, pull out a map sometime. Pull any kind of a map, a highway map, and look for the green areas on the map with boundaries around them. I don't mean national forests, but I mean wilderness areas and parks and state parks and national parks and wildlife refuges. There's a couple hundred million acres there now that were not there 40 years ago. and they're protected. They're protected because our country has enforceable laws. So I've seen far more protected. A lot has been messed up too, but these places are protected for good and forever, and the laws are there and they're enforceable. So I've seen it happen before, and I have great faith that the young people will carry on the banner.
You are head of the Endangered Species Coalition, and one of the biggest, it seems to me, endangered species success stories is the Rocky Mountain wolf, the restoration of that in the Northern Rockies, still highly controversial in the Northern Rockies, as you know, but that is from endangered species standpoint, for those who advocate for saving endangered species, that really is a great success story, isn't it?
Oh, my goodness, yes. Wolves were almost extinct. They're certainly still extinct in most of the country, except in a few places. And that is a great success story that the wolf has come back, and once it's reintroduced and protected, it can get back to it's doing its normal, shall I say, ecosystem function of, keeping the populations of other things down a little bit so things repair. For example, in the Yellowstone where the wolves flourish, guess what happened? The trout stream started coming back. And they got cold again because what they did was chase keep the moose and the elk moving out of the stream sides so that vegetation could grow back and make the streams colder. But anyhow, yes, the wolf is a great success story. We're a little concerned about what's going on right now, and these things have an ebb and flow to them, I think.
You have written a book. It's called Fight and Win, Brock Evans' Strategies for the New Eco-Warrior. Mr. Evans, I guess the title implies that you've learned some lessons over the years about what works and what doesn't.
It's basically the lessons I've learned over 50 years of campaigning to rescue the American Earth. And all these issues, whether you're in Florida or in Montana or Arizona, they're what I call love battles. People want to save those green places, not for any technical reason or certainly no economic gain. They do it because they love the land. And it's been my joy and my pleasure to work with these people in whatever states, wherever they are in campaigns and abroad too, to save these places. Yes, so the book is it's sort of a combination of, here's a tip. For example, if you want to go lobby, say, city supervisor or so on, research who they are first. Find out who they are. Find out what they like. Simple things that we think we do, but a lot of people don't. They just walk in, and then they get disappointed. Do that. Or things like that. Be sure to turn up at public hearings. But so there are little tips about what I've learned, and I tell some stories about how when we were faced with a hostile committee chairman coming in to decide whether we could get a new national park in my state, Washington, we knew he was going to try to kill the bill, so we put on a show. I hit the road for 3 months and organized, and we turned out 800 witnesses there. And the medium became, anyhow, it's things like that with my stories about how we did it.
What's your assessment of the efficacy of being adversarial versus collaborative, because that's sort of the new watchword of the movement, is collaboration is going to get you a lot farther than, say, litigation. Do you agree with that, and do you think there is a gradual shift in that sense or not?
I personally think that to the extent there's a shift is because the anti-environment far-right legislators have become so powerful in certain places that's the only way to get anything done, is to collaborate. I'm all for collaboration if we get something really good out of it, if all sides really get something good out of it. It would say, well, we want to collaborate over the boundaries of this proposed wilderness, and I'll take a fourth, and you take a fourth, and they'll get a fourth. Well, that means we only get a fourth of 100% that we wanted. If the collaboration is over a whole region, let's say the whole valley or something like that, where we work out where the houses go and where the hospitals go and the shopping malls and where the wilderness goes, then everybody gets what they really need. And I'm very much in favor of listening to what the other side is saying and what they want and see if there's a way to accommodate it. And my experience has been that we can usually accommodate most things people are concerned about 80% of the time or maybe more. Then if we tried to accommodate on the Magruder Corridor, it would be log on both sides and leave a little scenic trip along the side. That's not a compromise. To me, pardon me for going on, but it's sort of like saying, well, let's collaborate. So do we want to cut your arm off of your elbow or your wrist? Which one? That's not collaboration. We've lost so much wilderness already. But if collaborate means, well, you can keep your arm as it is, but I get to do so and so and so and so too, and that's fine with me. I think you need to be an adversary and prove that you have strength before you can be a collaborator.
But always good to find common ground, isn't it? Because common ground is the most effective.
Absolutely. And if you can find common ground, and that's why I come to believe that all Americans love the earth, love their land. It doesn't matter what party you are. You may have other views about the people who are advocating it, but you love it. Most people want a place to take their children and grandchildren hunting and fishing where they used to go, and they're sad when it's gone. And that's called legacy. I'll never forget a hearing I went to in Salmon, Idaho many years ago, and I was the only person advocating for a wilderness area there. But I heard rancher after farmer after rancher after business person from the local area saying, we don't want any wilderness. We want the place to stay just like it is. Well, that's the same belief system. I said, hey, yeah, we do too. So we collaborated on that. But people have to understand that what we're after is certainty too. We want to know the places we love are going to be there for our kids and our grandkids. And we want to know the hunting and fishing is going to stay good. I want to know that the house I built downstream of a new development isn't going to be flooded out because a new development pollutes a stream or something like that. Those are okay things to do. We can all have these things if we understand what the other person wants.
And so someday some young man from back east will come to Mini Glacier and stand there and fall in love.
That's one of Montana's greatest treasures. John Muir, who's a saint of the Sierra Club, said, Glacier National Park is the most sublime wilderness in North America. And I, after hiking everywhere, I agree. It's a fabulous place. Yes, some other young man will become a Montanan by osmosis like I am.
Well, I have been speaking with Brock Evans, longtime conservationist, president of the Endangered Species Coalition, former lobbyist for the Sierra Club, author of a new book called Fight and Win. Mr. Evans, thanks so much. Pleasure to have you in our studio.
It's a delight to be here and back in the state I love. Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. There is a winter weather advisory in effect until 11 a.m. tomorrow for snow for the Kootenai Cabinet region, the West Glacier region, the Lower Clark Fork region, and the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. That advisory is also in effect for elevations above 5,000 feet along the Rocky Mountain front and above 6,000 feet for Beaverhead, Madison, and Gallatin counties. West of the Divide tonight, rain and snow showers are likely with lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy. Rain is likely with a chance of snow, and highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 5 p.m. tomorrow for the Rocky Mountain Front and Eastern Glacier County, Cascade, Central and Southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, and Fergus counties. Tonight, rain showers are likely with lows 30 to 35 degrees. Southwest wind gusts could reach up to 65 miles per hour after midnight. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with isolated snow showers through the day and highs in the 40s. West wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour. Southwest Montana tonight, snow and rain showers are likely with lows 25 to 30 degrees. Southwest wind gusts could reach up to 55 miles per hour tonight. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with scattered snow through the day and highs 35 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Kyla Mackey.
In less than a decade, renewable energy generation has grown exponentially in the United States. In 2012, renewable energy accounted for nearly 50% of all new U.S. power generation. State renewable energy standards, policies requiring a minimum amount of a state's electricity to come from renewable energy, are an important reason for this growth. 30 states, including Montana, have adopted renewable energy standards. Over the next year, the Legislative Energy Interim Committee will be studying the economic and environmental impacts of Montana's renewable energy standard. This study presents an opportunity to describe how renewable energy has improved Montana's economy, protected our environment, and benefited consumers and local communities across the state. In 2005, Montana's renewable energy standard passed the legislature and became law. Its official title is the Renewable Power Production and Rural Economic Development Act. The law requires public utilities to obtain 15% of their power from renewable resources by 2015. Eligible resources include wind, small hydro, solar, biomass, and geothermal energy. Notably, the law passed with bipartisan support in both the Senate and House and was signed by Governor Schweitzer. Montana has tremendous renewable resources, particularly wind. It is not surprising, then, that Northwestern Energy, Montana's largest utility, is already on course to meet 15% of their energy needs with renewable energy 2 years ahead of the 2015 deadline. Renewable energy projects like the Judith Gap Wind Farm in Wheatland County and the new Spine Kop Wind Farm in Cascade County are supplying Northwestern's customers with affordable and clean energy. Projects like these are not only generating energy, they are generating jobs and tax dollars for our state and local economies and helping fund roads, bridges, and schools. Since 2005, renewable energy projects built in Montana have generated over $1.3 billion in capital investment, created hundreds of permanent jobs, and produced enough clean energy to power about 250,000 homes. The renewable standard has been a catalyst behind this development. Nearly all of Montana's renewable energy growth occurred after 2005, the year that the renewable standard passed. Expanding economic development in rural communities was another major driver behind Montana's renewable standard. Specifically, the law requires utilities to purchase a certain amount of energy from community renewable energy projects. These projects must be owned in part by Montana citizens, communities, or tribes. Several community renewable projects have been built since the standard passed. These projects help create good-paying jobs and boost rural economic development. For example, near Fairfield, Montana, the Turnbull Hydro Project generates electricity from a turbine placed on an existing irrigation canal in the Greenfields Irrigation District. Montana residents own this project, and local contractors help build it. Northwestern Energy purchases power from Turnbull to meet its community renewable requirement. Community renewable projects like Turnbull Hydro exemplify the build, buy, and benefit local principle, a principle that is just as important for energy as it is for food and other necessities. Renewable energy has also been good for our environment. Adding pollution-free renewable resources to our energy mix helps protect Montana's clear air and clean water. Unlike fossil fuels, renewable resources have zero direct carbon, sulfur, nitrogen, or mercury emissions. These emissions harm public health and accelerate global climate disruption. In Montana, renewable energy has displaced over 2 million tons of harmful pollutants that can contaminate the water we drink and the air we breathe. Cleaning up environmental contamination costs taxpayers money. It's simple. Renewable energy saves us all money by reducing pollution and its associated costs. Speaking of saving money, renewable energy also reduces our energy bills. Wind power helps stabilize rates by providing Northwestern Energy's customers with affordable energy. After energy efficiency, wind is the next least expensive resource in Northwestern's energy mix. Without a doubt, the renewable energy standard has been a good deal for Montana. The standard helped Montana develop cleaner energy that is less costly to consumers, taxpayers, and our environment. I am confident that the Energy Interim Committee's legislative study will substantiate the positive impacts renewable energy has had statewide. However, the 15% renewable by 2015 standard is only a start. Montana can expand renewable energy development and reap more of its benefits if we establish a more ambitious renewable standard post-2015. Experience has already proven that doing so would be a win-win for Montana's economy and our environment. In Helena, I'm Kyla Mackey with the Montana Environmental Information Center and the Alternative Energy Resources Organization. AERO has been linking people with sustainable agriculture and energy solutions since 1974. Visit AERO online at aeromt.org.
Kyla Mackey is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of this station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Madeline Beck.
And I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.